You're listening to The Big Interview, first broadcast on 3rd of May 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Andrew Tuck, and this is The Big Interview, a one-on-one show where people with extraordinary lives, powerful careers, and great tales sit down to tell us what really happened, how they got to here, and what makes them tick. War photography is a dangerous profession where the need to get the story and the urge to stay alive are often pulling you in different directions. It's also one where your personal life can be equally explosive, taken down by your own friendly fire. These are all things that Lindsay Addario could reflect on when she was kidnapped on the job in 2011 and thought she would be murdered.
That day in Libya, I asked myself the questions that still haunt me. Why do you do this work? Why do you risk your life for a photograph? After 10 years as a war correspondent, it remains a difficult question to answer. The truth is that few of us are born into this work. It is something we discover accidentally, something that happens gradually. We get a glimpse of this unusual life in this extraordinary profession, and we want to keep doing it, no matter how exhausting, stressful, or dangerous it becomes. It is the way we make a living, but it feels more like a responsibility or a calling. It makes us happy because it gives us a sense of purpose. We bear witness to history and influence policy, and yet we pay a steep price for this commitment. When a journalist gets killed in a firefight or steps on a landmine and loses his legs or tears his friends and family apart by getting kidnapped, I ask myself why I chose this life.
Born in 1973 in Connecticut, Lindsay Addario's journey from schoolgirl to shooting the world's grimmest war zones is told in her new book, Is What I Do. And her life, both professional and personal, warts and all, is also the subject of this week's big interview. Lindsay, who put the camera in your hand for the first time?
My father gave me my first camera. He didn't put it in my hand, but he had a client. He's a hairdresser, and he had a client who gave him an old Nikon FG. And I was over at his house. This was after my parents had gotten divorced. And I was over at his house one weekend, and I saw it. I asked him about it, and he sort of just handed it to me and gave it to me. And that really opened Pandora's box, I guess, in the sense that I started playing with it and then reading about photography and reading about light, and I never really looked back. I never thought photography would be a profession for me. It was always something that I looked at as a hobby or an art, and it wasn't really until many years later that I actually realized that it could be something that I would do as a profession and for the rest of my life.
And that ticking over from being somebody who enjoyed taking pictures to being a reporter, I guess, as in with many reporters, it happens with a little bit of bravado and a little bit of kind of, are they going to believe me? But perhaps you could just tell us about that step into being a professional photographer.
I photographed for so many years not as a professional that transition happened so sort of gradually and subtly that I didn't realize I had one day become a professional photographer. I went to University of Wisconsin and spent 1 year in Bologna studying at the University of Bologna in Italy. And all of my classes were in Italian. And of course, it took me several months to actually learn Italian. And in that time, I started doing street photography. Having a camera in my hand gave me a reason to be there and to just shoot on the street. So I started doing that. But again, I always considered photography a hobby. And then I graduated from university and decided I wanted to move to Argentina to learn Spanish. I had already learned Italian and I wanted to learn Spanish. And so I moved down there and was taking intensive Spanish classes. And in my free time, again, was photographing. And it was in Argentina that I became aware of pictures in the newspaper and how pictures were used to tell stories. And so I was seeing the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo. They were mothers whose sons had disappeared during the dirty war in Argentina. And every, I think, Thursday, they would march around the square. And I would go and try and photograph them. And every Thursday, I would go. And then I would see, sometimes those pictures were published in the newspaper. And it resonated with me in a way that I thought, God, if you can take a powerful picture of these women, you can really reveal their pain and how much they've been through. And so I would start trying to take these pictures more and more powerful in the same scene every Thursday. And then I went into the local newspaper and just started asking them for a job. And eventually, it's quite a long story, but I went in and said, you know, can I have a job at the Buenos Aires Herald? And there were two men who were just sort of smoking cigarettes. And they sort of looked at me and said, oh, you have no experience, you know, go away and learn Spanish and come back. And so I went and I learned Spanish and I went back and I said, can I have a job now? I speak Spanish. And they said, you know, and they would make up assignments. They would say, they would write down an address on a piece of paper, like way on the outskirts of Buenos Aires and say, okay, go take a picture of this house. And I always went. So then finally they realized I was not giving up. And they said, okay, Madonna is in town and she's filming Evita at the Casa Rosada. And if you can sneak on the set and get a picture of her, we will give you a job. So, of course, I went to the set and there were fortunately New York bouncers at the, you know, guarding the perimeter. And they said, you know, where's your press pass? I said, I don't have one. But I promise you, if you let me in, I will be a famous photographer one day and my whole career rests on you. And so the guy sort of looked at me and just rolled his eyes and was like, OK, you're so pathetic. And he just like waved me in and I got inside and there was a press riser. You know, there are all these TV cameramen and still cameramen. And I climb up the stairs and immediately everyone was annoyed with me because I rattled the stairs as I walked up. And everyone sort of looked at me like, oh, who's this novice? And I got on the riser and I picked my camera up, which was still the Nikon FG years later. And I picked the camera up and Madonna, the scene of the balcony was so far away, I couldn't even see the balcony because everyone had a zoom, a telephoto lens. Then this guy tapped me on the shoulder and he's like, hey, kid, give me your camera back. And I had no idea that a Nikon camera back could be used with any Nikon lens. I mean, I had no experience. And so he put my camera back on his like 600 millimeter lens. And I looked through the zoom and I saw the balcony and the scenes of crowds and I sort of squealed and he rolled his eyes again and I took a picture and I got a job.
It's great to know that Madonna set you on your way a piece of celebrity photography. And just before we move further into your story, we should explain you were born in America, American-Italian heritage, but we'll cover it over in the story. You've kind of been everywhere. Where did that gumption to leave America, to feel at a very early age that you could travel the world and do things, where did that come from?
I don't know. I think I come from a family. My parents were incredibly empowering. I have three older sisters, and my parents always encouraged us to do whatever we believed in, whatever we were interested in. They never inhibited us. Fear just wasn't a part of our childhood. I mean, the fear of failure, the fear of not accomplishing something, it just, we didn't talk about it. I mean, they never said you have to go to college. They never said anything. They just said, do what you believe in and you'll be successful.
Now, when you look at your life and the situations you found in that, that's a really key word, fear, because you certainly do feel it on occasion and you talk about moments where I think there's moments when you literally wanted to be home. You kind of thought this is getting out of hand. But in the end, it never has stopped you. Very early on in your career, you crossed into Afghanistan. Afghanistan at the time was ruled by the Taliban, notoriously grim treatment of women, very opposed to people coming in from outside. But you went. And that is, I think, the first time in knowing your story that you feel, I'm not sure that I would have crossed the border. I'm not sure that I would have put myself in this situation, even for the story, even for the greater good. How do you control that notion of fear?
It's interesting. I was 26 the first time I went into Afghanistan, and actually fear was not a part of that decision almost at all. I was living in India at the time, and so many of the foreign correspondents based in India were covering Afghanistan under the Taliban. So while the Taliban seemed like this terrifying regime, which it was, they were inviting foreign journalists in. If you can get a visa, you were able to work under the Taliban. So I felt like if I can get a visa, they will make sure I'm protected because the Taliban did not want foreign journalists getting killed or abused on their watch. So I got a visa thanks to Kathy Gannon, who was the AP bureau chief at the time in Pakistan. And my real fear was after I had gotten the visa, made all the contacts, and it was sort of as I was going in, like literally driving up through the Khyber Pass from Pakistan because there were no flights naturally at that time. And then I thought, oh my God, what am I doing? So I was already in the middle of it. And that I find is often the case with my work. I'm so driven by the story, by where I want to go, that the fear doesn't actually hit me till I'm kind of in the middle of it already.
When those moments of fear embroil you, do you have to remind yourself, you're very clear that you feel that a photograph, a good report, a story told well can change events, can change how people think about a situation. But how much do you have to remind yourself when you're thinking, okay, there's someone with a gun, there's someone who looks crazy, this is a situation that is properly out of control? And many times when you look at your story and when you read your book, there are moments when it's clear you don't know whether you'll come out of that moment alive.
Sure. I think certainly in those moments when I'm looking death in the eye, those are the moments where I have to remind myself, why do I do this work? And I ask myself repeatedly, what am I doing here? Why do I feel the need to be on the front line in Libya? And of course, those are the key moments when I have to ask myself those questions over and over. There are also moments in my personal life. You know, I'm very candid in the book about the failure of my personal life. For so many years, I tried to have relationships that fell apart. And in those moments, when I found myself heartbroken year after year, I couldn't make things work in my personal life when my professional life happened to be taking off. And those are the times when I ask myself, why am I so driven? Why can I not turn away from this story? And I just kept going back to Iraq or kept going back to Afghanistan or Darfur or Congo at the expense of my life. And I think it's important for someone to ask themselves those questions, who does this for a living, because we have to have some sense of not only balance, but we have to be able to justify to ourselves the risks that we take.
Could you tell us a little bit about the situation in Libya that led to your terrifying kidnap?
When the Arab Spring started, I was in, ironically, in Iraq, and it was sort of the one country that was not being touched by the Arab Spring. And I was watching Egypt take momentum in Tunisia, and then I was on assignment for National Geographic, and I was sort of desperate to get to Egypt at that time, and I couldn't leave my assignment. So I then was sent to Afghanistan, and by the time I got to Afghanistan, things were really taking root all over the Arab world. And I said to my editor at the New York Times, look, I have to go to Bahrain, because that's when Bahrain started taking off. And he said, okay. So I was pulled out of Afghanistan. I went to Bahrain. And immediately when I got to Bahrain, Libya started. And so I called my editor again and said, okay, now I want to go to Libya. He said, okay, go to Libya. You know, basically, he had a lot of people already putting their hands up, but I said, I'm going to go with or without an assignment. So he said, look, I'll send you in. So like every other journalist, I crossed illegally from Egypt into Libya. Gaddafi did not want foreign journalists, obviously, covering the uprising in the east. And so any journalist who wanted to cover that uprising had to sneak in illegally without a visa through Egypt. And so when we got to Benghazi, there was like a parallel government being set up. There was real momentum. It was very exciting. The rebels were sort of taking over and taking over all of these buildings that had been abandoned by the Libyan government. And it was a very exciting time. And it felt very familiar to me because I had already witnessed the fall of Saddam in Iraq and the fall of the Taliban in Kandahar. So I was able to use those experiences to know how to photograph. But very quickly, that momentum shifted into violence. And so the rebels started pushing west. And a handful of photographers and I started pushing forward with them. And so we didn't know what to expect. I actually hadn't brought a flak jacket or a helmet with me because I thought the uprising, very wrongly, in Libya was going to be like the one in Egypt and Tunisia. And so we pushed along the front line. And within days, we found ourselves in the middle of extremely heavy combat. And it was very one-sided. I mean, Gaddafi's military had, they were using airstrikes, they were using helicopter gunships to come in and spray the ground all around us with 50 caliber bullets. And they were using tank fire, mortar rounds, sniper fire. I mean, it was incredible. And we were very outnumbered. And also the rebels we were with didn't really know how to fight. I mean, they were teachers, engineers. They were people who had never really been in combat before. So I knew right off the bat that it would be dangerous. And so I spent about 2 weeks with several colleagues covering the fighting. And I woke up one day and I just said, you know, I got to pull east. I got to go back because I was exhausted. And I think a very important thing for a war correspondent to recognize is when they need a break. And I've always listened to that instinct. And so I called my editor at the New York Times and I said, I need to pull back to Benghazi. And he said, fine. So I stayed in the town of Ajdabiya, where the front line was at that point, with my colleague Tyler Hicks. And the next day, fighting was coming closer and closer, and we paired up with Stephen Farrell and Anthony Shadid, and we were in two separate cars that morning. And halfway through the morning, we were covering the fighting as it came closer. And, you know, if you cover war, you understand when a city's going to fall. I mean, civilians start fleeing. The mortar rounds are walking closer and closer to our position. There are signs that journalists begins to recognize. So we knew the city was going to fall. And we were in two cars, and the driver of one of the cars, his brother was shot at the front line. So he just pulled over in the middle of this chaos and dumped Anthony and Steve's stuff on the sidewalk and said, I'm leaving. And so they ended up in our car. So there were four journalists in one car. And we all had very different needs of what we wanted to cover before the city fell. And so we were kind of all over the map. We went to the hospital. We were covering civilians. We went back to the front line. And we just stayed too long, essentially. And at one point, our driver started getting calls saying Gaddafi's troops were in the city. And we knew that if we got caught by Gaddafi's troops, they would probably try to execute us because Gaddafi had made many announcements saying, if you catch a foreign journalist, kill them. And so, of course, that was one of the fears we had. And so we started finally pulling east. And as we started driving east towards Benghazi, we saw on the horizon, I was the first one to see actually what I remember very distinctly as little olive figurines on the horizon. And I said, those are Gaddafi's troops. And my colleagues actually laughed at me and were like, there's no way, they're ahead of us. They're still behind us. And what had happened was Gaddafi's men had flanked the desert and came all the way around the desert and cut the road in front of us. And we drove directly into that checkpoint. And as we were driving towards it, everyone was yelling a different thing. And our driver just panicked and he stopped at the checkpoint, opened his door and jumped out and said, we're journalists. And immediately Gaddafi's troops were on us and pulled all of us out of the car. I actually was left in the back seat. I had been sitting behind the driver on the left-hand side. And I sort of crouched down in my own lap and just was like praying that it was a dream and or a nightmare and wanted it to go away. And I peeked up and I was watching my colleagues struggle with each one of them had a troop on them. And at that moment, the rebels started opening fire on us and on the checkpoint that we were at, and we were caught in the crossfire. And so I knew immediately I had to get out of the car because the car was not bulletproof. So I crawled across the back seat and jumped out the right-hand side where my colleagues had also gotten out. And I made a run for it across the street because there was a cement building, and I knew that the most important thing was to get cover from the bullets. And immediately we met, the four of us made it to behind that cement building. And there was a moment where there was so much chaos that the four of us were sort of standing there behind that cement building for a second. And Tyler said, I'm going to make a run for it. And we looked around and there was nothing but desert. And it was completely unlikely that he would ever survive or be able to make a run for it because Gaddafi's troops were everywhere. And so we just looked at each other and immediately there were a handful of soldiers on us and they said, lie down on the ground. And it was incredibly violent and the soldiers were very angry. And I didn't think we would survive those moments. First of all, I didn't think we would survive the initial barrage of bullets, but also I didn't think we would survive that initial moment where they said, lie face down on the ground. And each one of us put a rifle to our heads and they were deciding whether to execute us. And their commander came over and said, you can't shoot them, they're American, which Anthony Shadid later translated for us. But there were moments where I was lying face down in the dirt and I remember being so thirsty and trying to beg for my life, but no words would come out. And I was trying to say, please. And I was looking up at the gun barrel and they just sort of stopped and said, get up. And then they asked us for our passports and everything else. And eventually we were each tied up and we were bound and put in vehicles back on the front line. And they sort of watched us and laughed at us as we sat as bullets and mortar rounds and tank rounds landed all around us. And they came over and punched us and punched me in the face and hit my colleagues and kept us there for hours. And basically, over the course of the first 3 days, they were very violent. They kept beating us. And for me as a woman, I was groped repeatedly, basically by every man who came in contact with us. And then we were transferred to prison in Sirte, which was Gaddafi's stronghold. And we spent a night in prison together where we were able to actually freely speak to one another. And then they flew us in a military aircraft, bound and blindfolded and tied to the walls of the plane by wrists and feet to Tripoli. And that transfer was very violent. And then we were put in a VIP sort of prison, which was an apartment. We don't know where, but we think on the outskirts of Tripoli.
Do you not even in those moments say to yourself, this is the final moment. I have to stop. This is getting too much. Even then, you have, are you aware that if you get out of this, you will probably continue?
Yeah. I mean, we had that conversation in prison, actually. I mean, one of the first things that when we were able to speak to each other, we said, Steve Farrell, I think he brought it up first, and he just said, I will never do this again. And me, Tyler, and Anthony didn't say that. We sort of looked at each other and said, our poor families, and we feel horrible. But there's never been a moment in my career, and not even in those darkest moments in Libya, when I really was just, you know, I never was sure I would survive.
Can I ask you about, you see extraordinary things, and then you bring those images back, and you're dependent on a newspaper editor, a publisher, deciding to run with them. And I think one of the worst moments in the book is you come back from Iraq and you have pictures of soldiers who have been terribly injured and they want their stories to be told. And you go to see a magazine, a photo editor who says, it's too much. We can't, people don't want to see this kind of stuff. But when you're out there, do you get crazy when you come back and you think, I know the truth, I've seen it, this is the story, and then we want it watered down and made acceptable for our palates?
Yeah, I mean, I never want to believe that my editor's not going to stand behind me. So I'm still idealistic in the sense that I assume that if I go to great lengths to actually get the pictures, that my editor, of course, is going to back me and publish them. So that particular story you're talking about was for Life magazine, and the military, ironically, had given us completely uncensored access to the wounded coming out of Fallujah in 2004. So I had all these incredible pictures of wounded soldiers, and every single Marine that I photographed, I had to ask permission. And every single one was proud to be photographed. And they said yes, and they were so excited about showing that they were giving their lives and giving their limbs to the war in Iraq. And when I got back, I sent the pictures to Life magazine. And they held them through the re-election of George Bush, November, December, January, February. And in mid-February, I got an email from my photo editor saying, you know, I hate to write you this email, but the editor of Life magazine has decided that we will never run these pictures because the American public can't handle them. And she wrote me that email sort of off the record, like she probably shouldn't have told me that. But I, of course, was furious because I thought, why do you even send people to war? How dare you make us risk our lives if you won't even risk your job, you know? And so fortunately, I had a great relationship with my editor at the New York Times Magazine. And as a freelancer, I am able to resell those pictures once someone passes on them. And so I called Kathy Ryan at the New York Times Magazine and she published them.
Now, another element of your story, which I think is really important, is your very open about relationships unsuccessful and latterly successful people that you fall in love with. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to tell us about the kind of more emotional side of trying to be a correspondent.
So I didn't, initially I was really averse to writing anything about my personal life in the book. And I wrote a 60,000 word proposal without a single mention of a man or a boyfriend. And my editor at Penguin in America said, look, do you really want me to believe you've never had a relationship in your life? You know, and I just said, well, I don't want to take away from my professional, my career, and I don't want to sort of water that down. And in the end, she said, you know, it's really important to write about how you try and have balance. So I wrote about these relationships, but in a way that I used them to show how I grew professionally and personally with every relationship. And I didn't want to write about the sort of superficial sex and all that stuff that goes on in war zones. I didn't want to go into detail about that because I didn't feel like it really contributes to a reader's knowledge of what drives me as a photographer. And sure, it's all there, but is it necessary to go into that and really dwell on that so much? No. My personal life, sure. When I talk about my failed relationships, I think that there's a reason why I go into those the way I do, because I learn from each one. And it's very clear that my job came first for so many years. And that's why I failed at all those relationships.
You also have a child now. I think one of the, anyone who does a flip that you can do, which is, I think, one of the most glorious comparisons of pictures, as a picture of a father carrying, I presume the father carrying a very young boy, and he's trying to get into a US Peshmerga run hospital and he's being turned away. And on almost the very final pages is a full page picture of your baby. And it's incredible. There's something, you've made the book have these very emotional touch points. Why did you decide to, you know, run that picture? Those two pictures, in a way, they tell kind of similar stories. Is your compassion for your child, his compassion? There's some really emotional strands that run through the book.
Well, I'm a really emotional person. I mean, I think that's sort of the only way I can answer that. I'm not the kind of journalist who goes into a situation and is stoic. I mean, I cry a lot when I'm photographing. I get scared. I laugh really hard and laugh from the heart. And I think that if you can't do this job and enjoy it and feel it with every thread in your body, then there's no point in doing this job because, you know, we are seeing people at their most vulnerable and at their greatest moments. And so I think I'm not removed from this work. And so it was important for me to show my vulnerability and to bring my son and to bring my husband and to bring the people I love into this book, because I think that's a big part of who I am. And they have been monumental in shaping me as a woman and the woman I am today.
Perhaps finally you could tell us, you have the husband, you have the baby, you have an amazing career. How will they balance out going forward from here?
Well, I am tortured all the time. I always think I'm not doing enough, and that because I have a great husband and an incredible son, and then I think, my God, my work must be going downhill. So I think, you know, for me, I'm always sort of stressing about the stories I'm not covering. So I, you know, for me, I never see further than the immediate.
Lindsay Addario, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with Lindsay Addario, talking to me, Andrew Tuck, on Monocle 24. Next week, our culture editor Robert Bound meets publisher, entrepreneur and Freeze co-founder Matthew Slotover. Thanks for listening and goodbye.